Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. Listen Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on KKOA 107.7 FM or at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Or to the podcast at lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Now here's your host and producer, Sherry Brackett.
Aloha, good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We have an extremely important race coming up this election season, and on August 11th, you are going to be asked to choose between several different candidates for governor who will advance from the primary to the general election on the Democratic ticket. One of those candidates is United States Representative Colleen Hanabusa, who is the great-granddaughter of Japanese immigrants, born in Honolulu and raised in Waianae. She has her bachelor's, master's, and law degree from UH and the UH School of Law, and she's been in public service for a long time, serving in the Hawaii State Senate from 1998 through 2010. She was Hawaii's first female Senate president. She served in the United States House of Representatives from 2011 through 2015 and then returned to Hawaii to practice law, and she became a member and then chair of the Honolulu Rail Authority. Representative Hanabusa returned to the U.S. House in 2016. She is on the House Committees on Armed Services, Natural Resources, and Science, Space, and Technology, and she's talking with us from her home in Washington, D.C., where she has to spend a lot of time because she is in the United States House of Representatives. Representative Hanabusa, thank you so much for joining us. Aloha.
Aloha. Thank you, Sherry.
You are running for governor of our state. Why are you running for governor?
I tell people that the reason I'm running for governor is because this is where my political journey has taken me. I think that all the different positions that I've held all lead me to this point. As you stated, I was elected in 98. I took office in 99. And what I share with people is, though for some reason everyone thinks I've been around a long time, it's really relatively short compared to many of the other people. For example, Governor Ige was already in office almost 14 years at the time when I got elected. And I served in the Hawaii State Senate for 12 years. Out of those 12 years, it was just a phenomenal and amazing experience. I was the judiciary chair and majority leader at the same time of the Hawaii State Senate, and I was, of course, the first woman to head either chamber, and I became Senate president for the last 4 years. And then when I went off to Congress, it gave me a totally different perspective. So what I learned there was the role Hawaii can play and should play and does play in terms of the global economic arena, and in particular what we now call Indo-Pacific, but we used to call Asia-Pacific. It was always my desire to serve the people of Hawaii in the best way that I can, and I believe that the way that it has worked out and that interests me the most is to become governor of the state of Hawaii. The reason is because of the fact that I just feel that the state needs to be put on the right track. I think we're kind of gotten off the track. I also feel that it is not acceptable that so many people feel that we're forced to accept less. And, you know, people have asked me, why are you running? We think you do a good job in Washington, D.C. It's kind of a backhanded compliment. And then I tell them, I said, do you like where you think Hawaii is going? And their response to me is, well, it can't get any worse, can it? And I said, well, that's the reason I'm coming back, because you shouldn't accept less. We're the most unique place in the world. And I say that because I see it from the lenses of somebody who is also serving in Washington, D.C. And I said, when I think about Hawaii, I think about what it can be, what it should be, and how many different, I guess, great initiatives that we started that are now being analyzed 10 years later. And I'm going, oh, my God. In all of the analysis, they all keep saying, well, you know, we haven't done enough. You know, sustainability 2050 was something that Russell Kokobung and I really spearheaded, and that was 2008. 2008 is also the Hawaii Clean Energy Initiative. I tell people, you got to give credit where credit is due. That was Governor Lingle and George W. Bush's initiative. And her relationship with President Bush resulted with all these concessions on how we would get to the clean energy, and it became the Clean Energy Initiative. And we also celebrated its 10th anniversary. And there are also things that need to be done. Also in that period of time, you know, you talk about infrastructure. I still remember that in 2008, the democratically controlled legislature actually passed the modernization plans for harbors and airports. We didn't get highways out, but it was because we knew we had to invest in infrastructure back in 2008. And look at what we're going through now. It's like, what happened in the 10-year period? So I look upon all of this and say, you know, it was so much a part of doing all of this, of coming up with what the visions would be for Hawaii and where we would want Hawaii to be. It's clearly a situation of being able to implement it, and it's also a situation where I believe what we're lacking is leadership. We need the leadership to see us forward so that we don't waste another 10 years in being aspirational and being able to create the Hawaii so the next generation would want to stay here and will have a place here.
Rep. Hanabusa, you have had several different positions in the last 10 to 20 years. Some listeners have expressed concern that if you become governor, you may not remain as governor for the full term. And the specific question I've been asked is, if a United States Senate seat becomes open, knowing that you did run for the United States Senate 4 years ago, I think, if that seat becomes open, would you appoint yourself to it, or do you promise to stay in the governor job for the full term?
Oh, I'm not interested in being in the United States Senate. And yes, I will stay for the 4 years, if so elected, and if I can get another 4 years, I'll stay for that 4 years. But like I said, this is where my political journey, I believe, leads me to. And to a certain extent, maybe this is how it ends, is in the governorship. And that's because this is what tugs at my heart the most, which is Hawaii. Hawaii is what matters to me. People have asked me that same question about, well, you have the experience in Washington, D.C., so why wouldn't you go there? And I said, because, you know, one thing Washington, D.C. has taught me is how to prioritize what's important. And what's important to me is Hawaii. And if I'm fortunate enough to be the governor, I have no intentions of leaving the governorship, and I will stay and serve in that position for as long as the people permit me to.
And a brief interruption to remind you that this is Island Issues, and I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bracken. Today, we're talking with United States Representative Colleen Hanabusa, who is running for governor of the state of Hawaii in the August 11th primary. She and Governor David Ige are the top polling Democrats, and I do have a request in to interview him as well. Next Sunday morning, we'll air an interview with Jay Ignacio and Kevin Walchin of HELCO about the impact of the lava flow on our island's electricity supply. Let's get back to Colleen Hanabusa in an interview recorded last Wednesday. Right now, one of the big issues for the Big Island, and actually for the state, is the lava flow that is affecting the whole Puna area, and it's impacted the rest of the state in a lot of different ways. If you win the governor race, you'd be inaugurated in December, and clearly we on this island will still have some serious issues. What's your thinking about what your first steps would be relative to addressing the lava flow specifically for the Big Island if you become governor?
Of course, the issue is public safety first. And I think one of the most fortunate things is we have not had any deaths. Though we have not had any deaths, we've had many people uprooted. So there's going to have to be the first thing are the people, especially the children, to make sure that they are safe and they have a place to either move to or to live in, other than the transitional type shelters which they are in now. Along that same line, in 2014, when we were here for the Senate race, one of the things that we did start here, but we never advertised it because it was not something that we wanted to politicize, is we helped form Puna Strong, which is a group of the ministers. I found that in a lot of these challenging circumstances, it is the churches that are best able to meet and to really talk to and soothe the people. So Pune Strong was there. So there's this sense of helping the people get a sense of more of a new community and so forth. Having said all of that, the people are clearly displaced. And what government is going to have to look at is what is the appropriate role that it now plays. In 2001, there was what we call the Kalapana eruption, which wiped out Kalapana. So part of that was Kuleana land rights, primarily in that area. So there was land set aside. And in 2001, I think it was legislation, again, that was offered by then-Senator Kokobong and myself, and OHA was also involved, is we did Kikala Kiokea. And I don't know if people realize that Kikala Kiokea was in response to Kalapana, and it became a subdivision. I think OHA's role, if I remember correctly, was in assisting them in getting to be able to build homes, a loan program, and the state side was to put in the infrastructure. And as you know, Kikala Kiokea is a community that was in response to that. And it was clearly something that when we developed and thought about, we gave the people who were displaced the first priority, because the idea was to recreate that community as best as we can. And then there were subsequent issues because there were additional lots available. It was the creation of whether or not the qualifiers would be the next generation and relatives, but it was to try and maintain that community. So we have some models. The decision is going to have to be made is who, and that's something that I think only those who are in government now may actually have that answer as to who would qualify. Having said that, however, the plan and the history is one that I know of. The real issue is those who had their businesses or their agriculture in that area, especially in the Kapoho area. What I was told, 80% of the papaya in Hawaii is grown in the Puna Kapoho area. 50% is in Kapoho. As we all know, Kapoho doesn't have that anymore. I met with the farmers, papaya farmers, as well as the amount of ornamentals, especially orchids, that were grown in that area. I also met a couple that grew avocado. They grew a whole acres and acres of avocado. And that's not going to be able to be recreated or replanted or anything in any time soon. But the question is going to have to be, what was the unique ecological measurements for that area that made papaya so successful there and made the ornamentals, the orchids? And there was one gentleman who came up to me and said he lost $5 million in terms of the infrastructure that he personally planted and set up.
Wow.
$5 million. Most of the lots in Kapoho were about 5 acres, but in his particular case, he had a lot. And, you know, those are the kinds of stories that you take with you, and you know that that's one of the things that, of course, for me, just listening to them and hearing what they have to say. And what they told me was something that I shared with you at the forum, was just tell us what the future is for us so we can move on or we can make the decisions. So you asked me what are the first things? One of the first things we have to do is we owe them all a realistic assessment as to what will happen and what can be the alternative for them. So that's one of the things that I continue to look at. What also concerns me about the impact of what's going on with the volcano is the economic impact for all of the Big Island, because what I had not known, and I should have known this, because in Congress I'm on Armed Services and Natural Resources, but I am the ranking member, the highest Democrat, on a subcommittee called Public Lands, which has National Park Service. What had not registered for me is that Volcano National Park has more visitors than Pearl Harbor. More visitors by 100-something thousand people. It's like, what does this mean? for the Big Island because it is the major attraction. So when I met with the National Park people and asked them, as well as USGS, they said 5,000 people a day. And they are, of course, concerned about what happens to the vendors. Are they losing their vendors? How do they then address it? So I said, okay, what do you need? Tell me what you need. And their whole issue was water and road repair and the safety aspects of it. Because as you know, there is, I think you call it KMC, Kilauea Military Complex, in the back. There's also that which is tied to the Volcano National Park as well. And people, families go and they rent that area too. It's not just the volcano. And they also explained to me what was going on with the volcano and why it didn't appear that anytime soon we're going to be able to go back, because the cauldron of the Halemaumau crater has basically collapsed in itself. When you see that, it's just amazing. And the other thing that I was concerned about, and it seems to be coming to a reality, is the Fisher 8 in Leilani Estates may in fact be a vent, just like Pu'o is a vent. And that changes the whole discussion. My understanding is what we all think of as Kilauea, the Halemaumau, the crater itself, when you look into it, it's barren. There used to be like a little lava lake. There isn't any of that anymore. So that was as of, I think, maybe two Fridays ago. And of course, my concern was, are you receiving enough federal support? What kind of funds do you need to repair? And, you know, if I can give a shout out to them and explain to people, they're amazing. They're so much a part of our community that they talk in terms of Madame Pele, like we're caretakers for Madame Pele, and it's almost stunning to hear them talk like that. And they have a very pragmatic approach to it, that they know they have to figure out a way to have safe access so people can see the volcano, because they know how important it is. They're willing to set up stations where people can come and they can explain what's going on and what it all means. And they just want to do their part because they feel they're so much a part of the Big Island community. They know the role that the volcano plays. That's also something that relationship and the ability to call upon them for their expertise and the fact that they want to help.
It sounds like what you're saying is you feel like state government's obligation would be to work through the state government funding and through federal funding to repair what needs to be repaired inside Hawaii Volcanoes National Park once it's safe to reopen, should that occur, and let's hope it occurs. Relative to the folks down in the Puna area, I just spoke this week with Kehau Costa, who's part of the Hawaii Island Board of Realtors, and she said that those folks who have lost their homes, who have gotten their homeowners insurance, are out there looking at homes so they can get a new home or get new property and build. What obligation does the state government have to those people who did build homes in Lava Zone 1 who have been wiped out? Does the state have the obligation, or does the county have the obligation, to actually replace those people's land and homes? And if so, what do you think the plan needs to be?
It's not a simple yes or no answer to that, simply because to the extent that the county permitted them to build on the property, issue building permits, for example, and knew that they had actually built on the property, I think they have different kinds of rights. They have different types of rights than those who may have just squatted and built something and it isn't insured and it isn't permitted. So it almost becomes a question of who has what kind of perfected right to the property. For those who there's no question that they have those rights, that the government should figure out some way, whether it's like a Kikala Keokea. What I'm not sure that we'll be able to do is Kikala Keokea, for example, was replacing a whole community, giving them the opportunity to live together again. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to do that, or that they want that. That's something that would have to be in a discussion. But depending on what government's role was in their situation, it's going to be analyzed along those lines. And for those who have insurance, I think that there's no question. For them to have the insurance, they would have had to be properly permitted and also within an area that the county allowed them to build.
Representative Hanabusa, where does astronomy atop Mauna Kea fit into your plan for our state, for the economy, and for technological advance?
You know, I've always been a supporter of Mauna Kea, and I've always made it very clear. I'm not sure that the University of Hawaii did a good job. And having said that, the question now is how do we keep this on track, so to speak? So as you know, on the 21st, the Supreme Court had its argument, and we have to wait and see. And there's also pending the decision on the actual sublease, the legitimacy of that sublease, and the Supreme Court has not ruled on that. So I would like to think that the Supreme Court is, I don't think it's going to be a unanimous decision. I think it may be like 3-2, and maybe 4-2, but 4-1, but it would permit that to happen. Mauna Kea and astronomy, to me, has a very important role for the Big Island in particular, but for the state and for the country, but primarily for the Big Island, because what it represents is a scientific basis and something that only you can experience on the Big Island, and you can only experience it on Mauna Kea. I hope what it does is it triggers a whole new different set of what people can invest in and what people can be proud of in terms of the education that it should create. One of the reasons why STEM was so popular and led on Maui is because Maui had the supercomputer, and why Molokai also benefited from all of the STEM and robotics and so forth was because of the presence of the supercomputer. Just the presence of something that is unique is what triggers it. And I think that's exactly what Mauna Kea and TMT should present for the Big Island and for the state.
You know, Rep. Hanabusa, one of the things you mentioned as we started talking was the work that went on in the state Senate when you were there with Senator Russell Kokoboon, who's from our island, relative to airports and other things. And, of course, there have been moves within the state legislature to attempt to create a public-private partnership to help manage airports. That same question comes up for hospitals. Public-private partnerships, is that something that you would see as important in moving our state forward? Because frankly, when one like me, as an outside observer, looks, it feels like we get stalemated. There's attempts to move things forward, and that being one way, and then not much happens. So give us your thoughts on public-private partnerships, particularly relative to airports and to hospitals, because here on this island, as everybody probably knows, we have two state hospitals. Rep. Hanabusa.
Public-private partnerships has its role in how government operates. But the one thing I do not support, for example, the airports, modernization was something that was on the books for a while. It shouldn't replace the inability to get things done. With all due respect, the same person who is in charge of airports during the Abercrombie administration is now head of Department of Transportation over the whole thing. It's almost like that's 8 years. And then we had, of course, 2 years before that when or some period of time before that when we had the modernization plan. So I believe that there are specific roles for public-private partnerships to play. It should not be simply because government can't get its act together. And when we had the modernization plan, the question is, why wasn't it implemented? So it's not a matter of punting, in my opinion. It's a matter of when it's something as systemic as that, we got to find out why it didn't work when you have the same people involved. Having said that, there are certain things that are going to require public-private partnership. And, you know, the Health System Corporation, which the Hilo Hospital, for example, is, that was almost conceived as a public-private partnership. It was the way it was set up that has caused some of the problems. And as you know, both Hilo, Maui, for example, they were always the flagship for Hawaii Health System Corporation. The problem, I believe, from the time I was in the legislature when I looked at it, and the reason why people feel that we need to do something, is when they assumed the role of acute hospitals. When they assumed the role of acute hospital versus federally qualified health centers, then we had a different paradigm shift. So if we're going to look at this, it's really going to be a matter of what is it that the communities want and what is it that the communities can really afford to support. Lanai, Molokai, all federally qualified health systems. I think one of the best examples of a successful federally qualified health system is Waianae Coast Comprehensive. That's something that works and services that community well. But the decision that Big Island will have to make and the elected officials who would have to make for the island is what level of care and how do you really render that care effectively for the people, and does it then require a total overhaul? Because it took a while for Maui to become transferred to Kaiser Health Systems. It took a while for that to happen, and the question will be, what is it, the expectation of the people? Do they want that, or do they want to see more of a federally qualified health system? And quite honestly, Sherry, I don't know what the answer is for that. I know everybody would love to have an emergency room like Queens, or for people like those of us who are in Washington, D.C., we may say all emergency rooms should operate like George Washington University's emergency room. Those are the choices that we all make, and there is no reason why people shouldn't have the expectation that they should be able to have an emergency room like, for example, Queens Hospital in Honolulu, but the practicalities of it is government can't do that. And the other issue is, would private sector, even with a partnership, would they take it up if the transaction doesn't pencil out for them?
It sounds to me like you're saying, does the Big Island need acute care facilities? And clearly, we're never going to have the...
No, you do. And that's what Hilo is. Hilo is like an acute care. The question is, on the Kona side, you also need an acute care facility. The question is, what would be the services that would be rendered for acute care? They don't necessarily do everything, and that would be the question. In Maui, they had this vascular unit, so people who suffered certain kinds of strokes would be able to be treated there, and some people actually from Honolulu go there to be treated, and this is when with Maui Memorial. So the question is, how much, what is it that when people say they want emergency type of facility, what level? I mean, we don't have that vascular unit in Honolulu, for example. If you want that type of vascular unit treatment, you have to go to Maui Memorial.
Listener submitted a question, quick answer. Union endorsements, you have many of them, and I know you're proud of them, but what is the quid pro quo? What have you promised for these union endorsements?
You know, I'm a labor lawyer, so I think when people give me the endorsement, a lot of them did so because they know that I understand the laws under which they function. I will say that I do believe in collective bargaining, but that's separate and apart from whether I was running for office or not, because I am a labor lawyer. And let me tell you why. I believe the greatest asset of any company, including government as an employer, are its people. To manage people in the numbers that you do, especially for government, you need a union. And it could be reflecting my prejudice is the fact that I believe that what unions do is they are able to represent vast numbers at one time. And then for an employer, you just negotiate the contracts with the unions themselves. And that's how we're able to function. In other words, they're an important partner in terms of how one manages the business, whether it's a government facility or teaching or whatever, that's how you're able to manage your workforce. If you don't have a workforce that believes fundamentally they're being treated fairly and they're being paid well and they're appreciated and you understand the work that they do, it's definitely not going to be in anyone's interest to ignore the role that they play. So that's my view, and that's the function of being a lawyer, a labor lawyer, and understanding how that whole collective bargaining process works. For example, the United States Supreme Court came down with a case called Janus versus Ashby that is going to affect collective bargaining and the ability for unions to collect what they call agency fees. To me, it still is a situation where having strong union representation is critical for your employees. In this case, the public sector employees are all members of some collective bargaining unit, except for those who are exempt or on the executive level. And that aids in a smooth running government.
So the question is, did you make specific promises to the unions to get their endorsements?
I would have to say no, other than what I just told you. What I told you in terms of my commitment is what I shared with the unions themselves.
One listener wrote in and said that a lot of decisions at the top of government don't get a lot of community participation. How can the community contribute their good ideas to your administration and have them actually heard and not just dismissed?
I've always felt that the best way to hear from people is to be among the people. I may not agree with you on everything, but I don't know of any conversation that I may or may not have had where I haven't learned something from that conversation or taken away some additional knowledge that goes into whatever decision that I may make. I find that it is the interaction with people that really helps define the problem. So that is why I can't say that I will have a community meeting every so many months or every so many weeks or something like that, notwithstanding. But I also can tell you that the one thing I do believe in is that if you need an answer or you need to understand a situation, you go in there and you actually have the discussion with the people. I did an interview with the Sierra Club, for example, and I did not get their endorsement. But one of the things that one of the persons that were there was saying is that you always make time for us and you've always been available and you have the discussion. We may not agree, but we have the discussion. That's who I am. That's my reputation. So I can only say that I don't intend to change. I didn't change when I went to Congress, and I don't intend to change if I become the governor of the state of Hawaii.
And that brings us to Representative Colleen Hanabusa. Why should people vote for you for governor?
People should vote for me for governor because I believe what people want in this state is someone who they believe is a true leader. And let me be clear about this. Leadership is not something that you self-proclaim. It's not something that we say, I'm a leader, so you should follow me. It's really something that is earned. So one of the things that I want people to pay attention to and possibly agree with is the fact that when it comes to government has basically three branches. It's not only the executive branch, which is what the governor is, but it's a legislative branch and it's a judiciary. And there are three co-equal branches of government. And in order for government to function for everyone, those three co-equal branches must function not necessarily together, but in respect of each other. So I believe why people should consider voting for me is that when I say that I bring the leadership qualification, it's not just me saying that. I believe that you will find among those in the three branches of government that they are very supportive of me because they may not like me, but the one thing I think I have managed to do is earn their respect. And they know that whatever I do would be fair. And, you know, when people feel that it's fair, they're able to accept a lot of the decisions that come from them. I also believe that the one thing that I have also shown people is that I can make decisions. As difficult as they may be, I can make decisions. And more importantly than that, I can explain to you why decisions are made and why I arrived at the conclusion that I did. And I do not shy away from that. So when people look upon me as somebody who's running for governor, I hope that they see somebody who has, for her whole political journey, reached a point where others who have come and crossed my paths and we have run across each other as we have both done this journey together or apart, that they feel that I am the right person for this job. For example, you know, one of the persons who really wanted me to come home and to run for governor was Shan Tsutsui, the then lieutenant governor of the state of Hawaii. And here is somebody who served under two governors. And of course, he resigned his position. He's actively supporting me on the island of Maui. I am very honored by that. I am very humbled by that, and I want to earn everyone's trust. We have lost so much public trust, and I hope when people look at my candidacy, they will get a sense that I can restore that public trust. Because if government doesn't have the public's trust, government doesn't have anything. That's why I hope people will vote for me, that they know that more than anything else, their trust is something that I covet. So thank you so very much, Sherry.
Thank you, United States Representative Colleen Hanabusa, running for governor. Thank you so much for being with us. Aloha.
Aloha.
And with that, a big thank you to our listeners. This is Island Issues, and I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bracken. We'll be back next Sunday morning with our conversation with Hawaii Electric Light Company President Jay Ignacio and General Manager Kevin Walchin about the impact of the lava flow on Helco and our power supply. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahoi ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues, brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us at info@labo105.com. Join us again next week for another Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.